Well, we just saw the burning of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And so Tim and I wanted to come on today and talk about the history of Catholicism in France and also some of the end time prophecies. These are private revelations. You probably heard of the great French monarch. So we're going to talk about the great French monarch. Also, there are some prophecies in Our Lady of La Salette about the burning of Paris. So we'll reference that. Obviously, the whole city didn't burn down, but we'll talk about that tradition. And then we're just going to reflect on this whole scenario and the tragic event of the burning of the Cathedral of Notre Dame, talk about some of the news coverage, and talk about whether this could be arson. No one wants to talk about that on mainstream media, do they, Tim? It's forbidden.
Don't seem to. No. And again, no one really wants to do it on a rolling tape either, because it's not 100% either way. But so we're going out on a limb here, but I don't feel it's that much of a limb saying it's a serious consideration. There's already been an ISIS subgroup statement celebrating the fact. And a lot of people saw my tweet on Facebook. Tons and tons of Islamic guys in the area putting smiley faces, and
yeah,
it's not that long of a limb, you know, to be out there on.
Yeah. I mean, it's we don't want to go on the record and say, you know, this was arson. We know who did it. This is ISIS, whatever. But to see some of the celebration on Twitter, it's shocking to me how much Twitter regulates conservatives and Facebook as well. I've talked to other people who are doing the same kind of stuff, and our stuff gets blocked. It gets demonetized. It gets flagged. I mean, both videos we did on Covington got flagged by YouTube, all that stuff. But then you go on to Twitter and there's Mohammedans rejoicing over the burning of the cathedral.
I know. Yeah. I feel like TNT got flagged like four videos in a row back in December or January, right?
It was January. It was like, they were just tagging us.
It wasn't even obvious videos by subject matter jurisdiction. It was like, you know, we were surprised.
Even our year end review got flagged. It's like, it's a year end review. Yeah.
What the heck is with that?
I mean, I get the Covington stuff, but so I suspect that this one will get flagged, Tim. I'm just guessing it.
Goody. Yeah. Bully.
but these guys are on there rejoicing over the burning of a cathedral. Happy face. Haha.
Happy face. They say, have a nice day. That's how I'm going to sign out from this show, is have a nice day. ISIS fanatics reveling in Notre Dame's tragic burning. Well, you know, we won't talk about the agency of it. As they describe the inferno as retribution and punishment. Also, it's worth noting just once that there was, for one thing, YouTube, speaking of YouTube, did you hear about this late yesterday? They fact checked an algorithm, a YouTube algorithm, which we're familiar with, because it incorrectly tagged live broadcast of the inferno at Notre Dame with a 9/11 attack conspiracy theory video. Did you hear about that?
Mm-mm. What do you mean they tagged it? Like linked it?
Yeah, what they originally did was their algorithm incorrectly posted. Oh, this is like a hate video or something on the details of the attack.
Right.
So, in other words, they thought this was 9/11 footage just by because of the creepy similarity of the falling of the spire. You know that video.
Yeah.
Thought that had something to do with 9/11, so, and you know, it kind
of. So the bots were like, "This is a terrorist attack," but all the humans were like, "This is not a terrorist attack. This is some wires got crossed in the attic, and the whole thing burned down."
With accelerant.
Yeah,
I mean, just so we get this out there, again, you know, we don't want to go too far out on a limb or whatever, but The story is very fishy initially, because you don't get a blaze, a conflagration that violent and that aggressive, usually speaking, particularly when people are there watching it, overseeing it. It broke out right at the end of the tourist day, and it broke out from the ceiling. You don't get that without accelerant or an explosive, usually. That's why people of goodwill are looking at this thing cockeyed.
Yeah.
But how do you, you know, if you have a little kitchen fire and it's during the day or the house is tended, you're not on vacation, you just, you know, put it out. So the facts aren't adding up here. ISIS is celebrating it.
Yeah.
And there had also been this slew in late March, around March 20th. It had been reported that there were 10 French churches being vandalized, attacked. And they're saying, watch out. In late March here, there seems to be a rising tide of anti-Christian church vandalism and worse.
Yeah.
Even someone made a cross out of human excrement in one of the churches. And they said, watch out, this is coming in April. And now we get this horrible Notre Dame conflagration. Right. And people are saying this has nothing to do with that. I don't know how you know that in the first 8 hours.
Yeah, I mean, our position here on TNT is we're agnostic, but open to more info and details. I just don't understand how, while the thing was still burning, the French come out and say, we have ruled out arson. It's like, oh, really? How did you rule it out? Did you go up there? Did you go up in the attic? Did you do an investigation? No, you just ruled it out. This is just feckless, yellow-tailed French weakness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just, sure. We're afraid. We're not going to say anything politically incorrect. We're just going to rule it out right away. And, you know, if a national, let's just call it national monument. In reality, it's a temple of God. It's a cathedral. It's also a national monument. If it burns down in Holy Week, maybe something's going on. Just want to say that. And why is it that if I ask that or say that or bring it up, people will say on Twitter, I even wrote a tweet on this, they'll say, it's too soon. That's rude. Don't go there. It's like, why? Why can't I say, could this have been arson? If you even, and it was asking the question. One guy even said, why are you jumping to conclusions? I said, I asked the question. You're the one that's jumping to conclusions, thinking that I'm jumping to conclusions to say that it was an act of terror, which I haven't ever said anywhere publicly.
Yeah, we haven't said that yet.
Yeah.
It's projection. Psychologists call this projection. Like, you're jumping to conclusions. I have jumped to the conclusion that this is nothing other than... Yeah, Shepard Smith on Fox News yesterday did this. Some guy was just like, look, obviously we have the suspicion that this could be terror. And he's like, no, shut up. Right. Let's go to a thing. I mean, it's creepy. And this brought back stark memories for me and probably many TNT viewers out there. Remember, of the late Bush era, you know, all Bush era, when we were having follow-up 9/11 types of terrorist attacks and attempted attacks, they're mainly being shut down, that the first day or so, the news ran this cycle. I don't know what they get out of it, aside from being, you know, left liberal and having an agenda. They would eventually, it wasn't a full conspiracy theory, they would report for the first day, just nothing about the etiology of the attack or who it was. And they would say, oh, someone saw the suspect. They would never mention any kinds of obvious Islamic indicia, right? That, someone saw that the guy had a head wrap or a big beard. They would never talk about that. And then it would, as if by some divine cue, you know, at the 23rd hour, all the news agencies would just start talking with their obvious leaked facts about. So this is, you guys guessed it, Islamic terror. It felt like that yesterday, except they were, I guess, a little bit more aggressively covering their ribs on it, even more than they used to back in the day.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but there had been on Drudge, they report, it's right up there as of now, there was a failed ISIS attack around Notre Dame in 2016.
Yeah.
Also, when you read the story, it's a little less, it's not so clear that it was on the church itself. But I mean, come on, Paris is Mecca West. And remember, five summers ago, the whole like downtown was on fire and they were rioting. Yeah. The police can't shut down the Islamic insurgents there. So it's a hunch.
Yeah. I mean, if it was the Cathedral of Krakow that burned down, I'd be like, man, maybe the fire alarms are broken, you know?
Right.
But when it's Paris, the Cathedral of Paris, I mean, go to Paris in the past 10 years and look around. It's a different place. you know.
That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Have you been there in the last?
I haven't, but I have family and friends who have, and they're just like, it's kind of lost its allure. You know, it's a different place.
You know, one thing, I've never been there either, but even all the,
well, I've been there, but I haven't been there lately.
Oh, you have been there.
I've been to Notre Dame and that whole area, so I kind of feel somewhat familiar with it.
Do you?
And while it was burning, I was mad. I was just thinking, man.
Me too.
This is our cathedral. And it was kind of crazy. Like, I was like, where are the hoses? Can someone just get a hose or like a soft drink and like throw at the building? Like, where's the water?
Yeah, really.
Trump,
right.
I like Trump. Trump was like, let's get some helicopters. Yeah. Drop some water. Just do something. Like, finally, finally after the whole roof is on fire, you see hoses shooting in there. I'm like, how come it took guys so long? You'd just have like a, if you're the Paris Fire Department, like, here's our plan for burning buildings. And then we also have this thing called Plan A in case our most valuable building, Notre Dame Cathedral, catches on fire. And that's that plan, you know, and maybe you have some extra fire hydrants around the building or something. But even when you watch the video, they're kind of like getting out of their fire truck. They're not hustling, unrolling the things, hooking them up. I'm like, guys, come on. Church is burning.
Put some stank on it. Yeah.
Let's get some water up there. But anyway, the other thing that bothered me that was making me really mad was listening to the commentators. I don't know why, but I was stuck. I was on NBC.
Ew.
And I was watching, because I was watching that tower, and I know it's just sitting up there and the thing's burning all around. It's going to fall. So I was watching, waiting for that, and I didn't want to change anything. And on NBC, they were saying the most ridiculous stuff you've ever heard about so-called Catholicism. The building is named Notre Dame, which in French means Our Lady. This is a way of showing respect towards the building. Like, they had no idea it has to do with the Blessed Virgin Mary. I almost like picked up my monitor and threw it out the window. I was like, how can you be like, this is the place of Napoleon and Joan of Arc. I'm like, no, it's not. Joan of Arc was not here. You just, in your mind, you think, what's a French saint? Joan of Arc. Okay, Joan of Arc was here. No, she wasn't. What were some other things they were saying? It was just unbelievable that, this is the number one place to take photos. This is the photo op place in Paris.
I'm like, well, that's what's most important about it, clearly.
Yeah. And they're, you know, one of the greatest pastimes for Parisians is to go and have a coffee or just sit outside in the plaza right there in front of the church. I'm like, that's the great pastime of Notre Dame, is to go have a coffee outside. Don't they know anything's inside, like altars, the crown of thorns, right, the Blessed Sacrament, relics? I mean,
you kind of feel like this listening to secular news reports about Catholic events when we pop into the news, when we are forced by hook or by crook into the news. It's kind of like when you're around your Protestant friends and they're trying to be semi-charitable for a moment, and it's like your Protestant buddy's describing to his mom, like, yeah, so they were at their
services,
Romantic cathedral, their services, and they had their little witch doctor doing their spiritualism and their their superstitious rites in a really there's kind of a beauty to it, and so the witch doctor comes down and he utters an incantation, you know, and the whole congregation all at once breaks into applause, and there's tremendous
commotion. Make a difference, singing "Go Make a Difference."
Yeah, it is funny because I doubt they're trying to bag on it for once.
It makes me wonder how much they're BSing on everything.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that hard of research to get done.
Yeah, another one she said was, this is where Joan of Arc was beautified.
Beautified.
Now, I didn't check that. They might actually be correct that Joan of Arc was beatified
there. What she meant is Joan of Arc went to cosmetology school outside in the alley behind.
Exactly.
So Notre Dame, what's the deal?
So there's just some intern who's, you know, probably some crazy New Yorker kid with blue hair and ripped up hipster jeans, and he's like running to Wikipedia and just, you know, trying to grab some facts and handing them to whoever's on the mic, and they're just saying, yeah, when I went there 3 years ago with my family, we just sat out there and everyone's asking, can you take a picture of me and my family in front of the beautiful church? And there's zero understanding that this is a temple of God.
That's right. I was surprised to learn that it's considered the number one tourist attraction in Paris, and it's ground zero for the city. In other words, all distances to Paris, France, are measured from the cathedral itself.
Catholic. It's more important. How very Catholic.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see Macron came out and he said, in our great secular republic, direct quote, in our great secular republic, this sort of thing is not supposed to happen, even to like the spiritualists, you know. But like, I mean, I don't know if he said it exactly that way, but he said our great secular republic. It is interesting to note that in the secular post-republic of France, they still take all this national pride in Notre Dame.
Yeah.
But yeah, but even though it's theirs and it's the number one tourist attraction in a secular republic that's actually quite anti-Catholic after the French Revolution, like you said, Taylor, it felt personal to us. My wife was getting really emotional. It feels like it's ours. It's not France's. It's every believing Catholic in the world's.
Yeah. Yeah. As they said on the news, also NBC, this was the male voice speaking. Now, this is the official home church of the city of Paris. Notre Dame is the home church. And I was like, a home church? It's a cathedral, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cathedral.
You know, like the home church.
Like sports game? Away? Home and away? Yeah, this is the home. We have home court advantage.
Well, I think of home church. Some Protestants do home church where you stay home. Like, it's the Sunday after Easter and you don't want to go to church, so... If you're processing, like, hey, let's do home church. And that means the dad gets a Bible out and does a reading and a little sermon. And then you sing a hymn and then you have waffles. Mm-hmm. That's home church, you know.
Waffles, which are symbolic of the Last Supper.
That's right. Exactly.
Eggs.
Yeah. So I wanted to mention just quickly the history of Catholicism in France. The tradition in France is that the original evangelizers of the French people were none other than Mary, Martha, and Lazarus from the Gospels. That when persecution hit the Holy Land, when the high priest and Jewish leadership were trying to kill the apostles, they jumped on a boat and went to France. And Mary Magdalene kept a hermitage there, where she wept and did penance. And you can still go there. I mean, it's a major pilgrimage site. The main impetus for conversion was Clovis I. He was a pagan Frankish king. He was baptized by Remigius in 496. This isn't a lot of art. It's a really popular theme. He became the kind of initial Western protector of the papacy. And that gets, you know, really consolidated by 800 when the Pope crowns Charlemagne on Christmas Day 800 as the Holy Roman Emperor. And that's what kicks it off. Because by this time, the Byzantines are sort of selling Rome short and not protecting them. So Rome looks for local talent, you know, to be the mall cop to protect them. And that's the Franks. They come in. This is why the French are, France is the eldest daughter of the church. The eldest daughter of the church is France. And so because of that, there's a lot of prophecies, end time prophecies, that France will be ground zero in the end times, in a bad way and in a good way. And also Notre Dame contained some pretty amazing relics. I mean, the Crown of Thorns, which was allegedly rescued during the fire. A chaplain for the fire department went in and got it.
Now, Father Fournier went in.
Props to him.
Let's just say real fast. I'm going to forget that. Can you imagine what a beautiful martyr witness that informs if something had happened to Father Fournier? If you went in there and first most important item to be taken out of the church is, of course, our Lord's body, blood, soul, divinity, right? And can you imagine if something had happened to him and he died and he had the chance to utter like a last sentence, like, this is our Lord. What a beautiful witness to the sacrament that would have been. Because all the French people were worried about the crown of thorns. They actually knew it, you know, again, in an almost beneficent way, they're kind of deferring to the fact that the Crown of Thorns is an important historical artifact. But more important than even the Crown of Thorns, also rescued by Father Fournier, was the sacrament. What a beautiful witness that would have made. I'm glad he survived. I'm glad he's okay. But there's that. And I think it's confirmed that the Crown of Thorns was rescued.
Yeah, you had some, before we ran tape this morning, you had some details on the Crown of Thorns. Why don't you, you got that? Can you drop that? Crown of Thorns get to Paris?
So it was actually King Louis the Ninth, blessed king, bought it from the young ruler of the Latin Empire of Constantinople, Baldwin the Second. Sounds like like an American guy.
Sounds like a baller.
He does. 1239.
If he's selling the Crown of Thorns, he kind of is a baller. Because that's simony to buy and sell relics. Was this a large donation that was made that had a party favor that included the Crown of Thorns? I mean, how does that work out in the 1200s?
Let me read you. This is actually, Witnesses to Mystery. It's a great book by the same two Polish guys, Grigory Gorny and Janusz Rosikon, who did the Fatima picture book, and lots of great information in there as well. I've read from that before. It says, despite his position of power, Baldwin II endured tough times. He ascended the throne at the age of 12, and out of necessity had to mature very quickly. His early rules were beset by the need to preserve not just the dynastic line, but also his life. The Byzantine capital had been invaded several times by Greek and Bulgarian forces. And in 1237, the 20-year-old emperor traveled to the West to seek help from other European powers. I thought this part was interesting. Pope Gregory IX, remembering the slaughter committed by the Crusaders in Constantinople in 1204, refused Baldwin any help. He feared that the intervention of Western soldiers might again result in the pillaging of the Byzantine capitals. So he'd been unsuccessful in Rome. Baldwin then traveled to Paris. King Louis IX was a deeply religious man, possessed of a number of Christian relics. He is reluctant to provide military to help to Baldwin, but he made the Byzantine ruler an attractive proposition. I like that. Give me that crown. Give me the Crown of Thorns. It arrived. They ended up cutting a deal here. It arrives in Paris on August 18, 1239. It was declared a feast day from a large tribune that had been constructed, made outside the city walls. Clergymen greeted the relic, which was then placed in a gold reliquary. King Louis and his brother Robert, both barefoot and wearing only linen robes, carried the reliquary through the streets of Paris while whole crowds fell to their knees and blessed themselves. This is a French population that was, like you said, the eldest daughter of Christendom. They knew what to do. They weren't calling it like a witch doctor, like a magic.
Totem,
right? As one eyewitness account put it, the kingdom had never experienced a day so full of festivity and joy.
Wow.
He made a bunch of other reliquary purchases from Baldwin II, so he was a baller.
Yeah.
A balder.
That's amazing. I looked up the dates on that. Thomas Aquinas was 14 when that deal went down.
Right, right.
He died in 1274. I was thinking he had to be alive then. I wonder how old he was. So that means when Aquinas was in Paris, he would have been able to venerate the Crown of Thorns. Pretty cool.
Newly.
It'd been a big deal. Yeah.
He just come to University of Paris. That's right. That's an interesting context. Yeah. It probably 5 or 7 years after
it got
this had been a big deal. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So,
also,
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so this is also related. When I kept hearing the age of Notre Dame Cathedral yesterday, I was thinking, okay, so this is close to the time of the great Western Schism and the Avignon Papacy, right? Because the construction of the cathedral wasn't even finished until 1345 or something.
Correct. And began in 1163.
Right.
So it was almost 200 years of building.
Meaning it was going on during the Avignon Papacies.
Yeah.
Right. So it's
So Thomas Aquinas would have seen it in construction.
That's right.
Yeah, it would have been about 100 years into the project with another 100 years to go. Yeah. So you want to talk some about the end time stuff? Because when I was watching it on live stream, I was thinking, is this the end of Paris? I mean, what is this, you know, is something going to happen? And the sources for the burning of Paris, actually, you know, these are private revelations, so take them or leave them. But the main source for it actually comes allegedly from St. John Vianney, the Cour des Arts. And I want to read also La Salette, which is an approved apparition. And I'm going to read the Cour des Arts first. This is St. John Vianney, allegedly. I don't know how to verify some of these quotes. On Our Lady of La Salette, for the book Infiltration that I did a ton of background research, and I know it's highly contested, and I think I can bring some clarity on that. But the John Vianney
quote. I was asking you before, sorry to jump in. I was asking you before, hey, I've always heard this La Salette is kind of bifurcated in terms of what the church approved and what people argue is not fully approved.
Two versions of the secret, the 1851, 1879. They're similar but different. And well, let me do the Cour des Arts and then we'll do that one. All right. Yeah. So this is St. John Vianney. It's a two paragraph quote, but I want to read the whole thing. Okay. So the enemy will allow the burning of Paris and they will rejoice at it, and they shall be beaten. They shall be driven entirely from France. Our enemies shall return and will destroy everything in their march. They shall arrive near Poitiers without meeting any serious resistance. But there shall be crushed by the defenders of the West who shall pursue them. From other directions, their provisions will be cut off and they shall suffer serious losses. They will attempt to retire towards the country, but very few of them will ever reach it. The communists of Paris, after their defeat, shall spread themselves through all France and will be greatly multiplied. They shall seize arms. They shall oppress the people. Lastly, a civil war will break out everywhere. These wicked people will become masters of the north, the east, the south, the west of France. They will imprison very many persons and will be guilty of massacres. They will attempt to kill all the priests and all the religious, but this will not last long. People will imagine that all is lost, but the good God shall save us all. It will be like a sign of the last judgment. God shall come to help. The good shall triumph when the return of the king shall be announced. This shall reestablish a peace and prosperity without example. Religion shall flourish again better than ever before, end quote. So this is kind of cool. I knew you're going to like it, Tim, because it has Return of the King. This is pre-Tolkien Return of the King. And this is one of the locus classicus for the great French monarch. There's this belief, it's in a lot of private revelation, that there'll be a time of great apostasy. After the time of great apostasy will arise the great French monarch, and with him, the Holy Pope, who will be the holiest pope who ever was. And these two men will work in tandem to bring about a great Catholic civilization. And towards the end of that period, which some people identify with the Age of Mary, towards the end of that period will come the advent of the Antichrist. So that's sort of what people have pieced together from some of these private revelations. And this is one of them. So there's also another one by another guy who talks a lot about this is a mystic named Bartholomew Holzhauser. He's a venerable in the church. And he talks about how this great French monarch will go and break up the Mohammedan kingdoms and conquer the Mohammedans. Hmm. That'll be part
of
the
timeline on that. Do we have any on any of the either of these two? No timeline.
No, not that I know of. He also there's a prophecy from Saint Bridget who says that the great French monarch will restore the cathedral of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, Istanbul, that beautiful, biggest cathedral, right? So yeah, that's that. Now also there, you know, he mentions that Paris will be attacked and destroyed, but also Melanie, who is the female seer at Our Lady of La Salette, she received a vision from Our Lady of La Salette, 1846. Here's the timeline. This is why there's a controversy. In 1851, she is pressed by the cardinal and her local bishop to write down the secret that Our Lady at La Salette gave her. Writes it on a piece of paper. The first time she writes it, they reject it. She has to write it again. Part of the controversy is that secret mentions the burning of Marseille, the burning of Paris, and the coming of the Antichrist from a nun, born of a nun. And that Rome will lose the faith or be eclipsed. So for some reason, she has to write it a second time. It gets sealed and it gets sent to Pius IX in Rome. Lost. Until 1999, they find it in the archives of the Holy Office.
Right.
She goes from convent to convent. She's getting in trouble a lot. The French bishops don't like her because she's very anti-Napoleon III. They're trying to bring a concordat with Napoleon III. She's very anti-Napoleon III and anti-Freemason. This is all in the 1860s and 70s. In 1879, she gets an imprimatur from a Catholic bishop to write down the secret and publish it to the public. She does. Immediately, the Holy Office says, this is forbidden, ban it. But it keeps getting printed throughout the years. The 1879 is all we had until 1999. We had the 1879. We thought the 1851 version was lost. In 1999, the 1851 version was found in the archives of Rome. So now we have two versions of Our Lady of La Salette. The 1851, which has papal seals on it, which was the one that she really wrote 5 years after the vision. The 1879 version, which was made public, is also available. You put these side by side, which I do in my book, Infiltration, and you realize it's kind of the same story and the same details, but the 1879 has a lot of extra details in it. For example, the 1879 says that the Antichrist will be born of a Hebrew nun, a nun of Jewish descent. Those kind of details. So people today say Melanie lied. She made the 1879. She was an older woman. She, you know, was influenced by maybe sermons or apocalyptic literature. And so the 1879 version is corrupted. It must be rejected. We only go with the 1851.
Yeah.
Both versions say that Paris will be burned, by the way. So
I knew that. I did.
It's indisputable. So Paris will be burned and destroyed.
Infiltration, do you come out and all but vindicate the 1879? I mean, what's your point of view?
So here's the thing. The 1879 says that Rome will be eclipsed and Rome will become the seat of the Antichrist. This is when you go to traditionalist websites, especially Sede Vacantist websites. They are quoting this all the day long. It's one of their favorite passages, right? Our Lady of La Salette said Rome will apostatize, period. And they just cite it. And then since 1999, people who are non-trad say, well, that was the corrupted version of the secret, the 1879. If you go back to the 1851, there's no mention of that.
I know.
Right. And so I felt if I'm writing a book called Infiltration about the infiltration of Rome and the Catholic Church and apostasy, I better speak to La Salette because everybody wants to know what's the deal. What I found is that Melanie says that she received a vision as well as these words from the Blessed Mother. And if you look at the 1879, she actually makes a reference to this thing she saw when the secret was given. If you look at the 1879, it's just more visual, right? It has more visual details. So my take on this is Melanie she died in the odor of sanctity. The local bishop loved her. The local people loved her. Pius X called her the little saint.
That's right.
Or he called her our saint. Nostra. He called her our saint. So how can it be that she would create this giant apocalyptic lie and deceive all of these people if she were holy and died in the odor of saint? It doesn't make any sense. She either, you know, it's like liar or lunatic. You know, she was either lying or she was crazy. I don't think either is possible. I think the solution to it is what we see in Fatima. And that is there's a visual part and there's an auditory part. And when in 1879, she gives the whole vision of it with the words. I mean, the content is similar. It's just fleshed out more. So I think both are valid. both are true. I don't think there's any contradiction between the two. The 1879 is just fuller. So I accept them
for
as
the
both.
Sake of clarity. 1879 has not been church approved bishop.
It received an imprimatur when it came out in 1879 from the local
did
bishop.
It
did. Yeah, she did it with permission. She was not being sneaky. She went through the right avenues to publish it. When it got to Rome, and I document all the letters back and forth and the years in which all this happened. I don't have all the years memorized right now. When it got to Rome, they asked for it to not be printed. And then years later, they put it on the index of forbidden books.
So that is confusing. That's confusing.
Well, so here's the thing. It doesn't necessarily mean they never said it was wrong. They said it couldn't be printed or distributed. And it's kind of like there's other books like that, too, like the Diaries of St. Faustina were put on the index of forbidden books.
That's right.
But were taken off and then later received approbation. So, again, there is no record because I looked for it. Is there any record of the Holy Office or anything where I'm saying the 1879 La Salette vision is bogus or fake? No. It's only this should not be printed or distributed.
Good.
So
that's
yeah.
good.
So if you say the 1879 is bogus, you have to say Melanie is a liar. She went nuts. She was bad. And then you have all this counter witness saying, no, she was actually a holy person who was even, you know, celebrated by the likes of St. Pius X. Which is it? I think the easiest solution to all of this is to say they're both true. The 1879 contains more. The 1851 contains less. 1851, she restricted herself just to the nugget of the secret of Our Lady of La Salette. So anyway, all of that is documented with a lot more and footnotes in my new book, which comes out in 1 month, called Infiltration. It's not about La Salette. This is just an appendix and a side point, because I knew everybody interested in this topic are all going to say, but what about La Salette? So I just felt like it had to be handled.
Well, it's one of the first things I said to you is,
yeah,
what about I've always felt I needed to do more research on La Salette, because the 1851 versus 1879 controversy, it's highly analogous to the, you know, Fatima secret 3A versus 3B. Is there a 3B? It's natural that you see this kind of dichotomization happen when seers naturally, particularly in the 1800s and the early 1900s, the best way of memorializing those documents or those visions, rather, was through creating a document by writing it. And, you know, you write different things at different times. So it's not, if people out there are like, why does this keep happening with apparitions?
Yeah,
it's natural. You know, I mean, nowadays there might be a couple different version of Microsoft Word or whatever, if a nun wrote it down on her laptop.
But
I've always felt in all seriousness that I needed to do more research on La Salette. One hears X from this friend, and you go research it, and you hear X prime the opposite, saying, no, that's totally bogus. It's confusing,
it's very,
and yet incredibly relevant. And again, the common red thread that runs through both La Salette and Fatima, of course, is the idea of the potential idea, I don't know quite how to phrase it, of apostasy within the church, widespread apostasy within the church, and the ruin of these, you know, ancient Christian cities being a kind of physiognomy, that's for you, Pope Emeritus Benedict.
Here we go.
A physiognomy of the apostasy, the rot, the wood rot within. And it's hard to deny when something like what happened on Monday happens, and Notre Dame, you know, great, one of the great churches of the world, you know, arguably the second most popular church in the world, goes up in flame. And it has so many indicia for us, you know, and that's just one of them. That's probably the most important one, if true.
No, I mean, you know, and she also, you know, she mentions a king. She mentions, you know, it's too much to read. You know, the 1879 is a little bit longer, but it's definitely, you know, she says even in the early 1851 approved one that a great king will ascend the throne and reign for a few years. So she also has reference to this future great monarch that from the context of her of her vision here, it seems that he also is French. And so there is some role, you know, just as France is the eldest daughter and she came and provided protection for the Pope in Rome and in a sense set up the Papal States and got that whole thing going. So also it seems that in the end times that that will be mirrored. It will be reproduced in the life of the church of some great French monarch who wins back Hagia Sophia and Constantinople and pushes back and destroys the Muslim kingdoms and then brings about this time of spiritual joy and prosperity. I hope it's true. You know,
it sounds great.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. But Paris will be destroyed. I mean, we gotta accept that. And I guess that means that Notre Dame, I mean, they're going to try to rebuild it. But I think if you are to believe these private revelations, of which you are not required, Paris does have a negative outcome in the eschatological view of these private seers. Mm. You know?
Yeah, people are getting really upset with good reason over this beautiful rose window that was added. You know, that I think had been replaced after the French Revolution. And there's three rose windows. Mm-hmm. I think the main one's on the south side of the building, but that the fate of the rose window that everyone's getting so emotionally bound up with is not yet known as of right now exactly what it is. There have been reports that it's been shattered.
Oh, I had heard it was going to be okay, but
there's countervailing stories,
right?
You know,
and I'm sure
there's no glass on the ground.
As it cools down, I mean, it's probably just now cooling down. I'm guessing, as the time of us recording this, you know, there'll be, I mean, wind is going to hit that thing, rain's going to hit it. I mean, it's not over yet. Also, right. We didn't mention that I don't know what happened to the relics of St. Denis, St. Dionysius of Paris, and St. Genevieve, who are patrons of Paris. I believe they're also in the cathedral, and I didn't hear if their relics got rescued or if they were damaged. I'm curious about that, too, because those are key relics for the city of Paris.
A lot of the relics there had been removed because of this renovation. So that was convenient and towards circumstance.
There's apparently some celebrated statues of the 12 apostles that had been removed. So they're good.
Yeah, they said it was 14 bronze statues of the 12 apostles. So I was like, how the hell does that work? So one of the apostles is sawed in two or what?
Well, you could get it by having, okay, the original 12. And then Judas is a bad guy. Does he still get a statue? He's replaced by Matthias. And then you've got Paul, who's always been kind of the 13th apostle. So that gets you to 14. But why would you include Judas? Yeah, why would you include Judas?
One of the coins, you know, a man gave his mother three coins totaling 15 cents. One of them was not a nickel. It's like, it's too early in the morning. Yeah. How is it? I guess you Marshall could have just figured it out. But I read that in two different stories. It's like, can someone just be forthcoming about who these other two statues are?
Well, I think you see, I think it's on the top of St. Peter's, there's Christ and the 12 apostles, but I think he's flanked on either side. Gosh, I'm probably going to make a mistake here. People are going to make fun of me, but I think it's Our Lady and John the Baptist might be with them there too, because they're always proximate in art to Christ. That would also give you 14, but they're not apostles. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, don't trust anything NBC or CNN saying on any of this stuff.
Yeah, it goes back to the principle I was talking about before, where the explications of, you know, religious art involves iconography, which involves aspects of theology itself. So there's a subject matter incompetence on the part of ABC, NBC, CBS, even Fox News, you know, where it is almost comical. They're like, so the religionists, the father in charge, is the chief spiritualist at this this station.
At the home church of Paris.
He's the apothecary of the home church of Paris. And he does magic rituals. It's like,
well, that brings us to something we need to cover, and that is that this was a divine sign. We've seen when Benedict XVI resigned, lightning struck the dome of the Vatican. Yeah, you could say it's chance. I'm sorry. I'm a Bible reader. I see apocalyptic signs. That's not a chance that lightning strikes the Vatican when a pope resigns. God is saying something. And I think in this as well, because in a way, Notre Dame is not just the spiritual heart of France. Other than Rome, I think it's sort of the spiritual heart of Christendom.
Christendom, yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, second to Rome in continental Europe. This is ground zero. Like you said, everything in France is measured from Notre Dame. That could be said for the whole continent. You know, this was the home church, to use the language of NBC. Yeah. This does symbolize Christendom. And in, you know, the reading on Palm Sunday, the Passion reading on Palm Sunday, you know, it talks about Christ being rejected by his own and being betrayed. And in fact, on Palm Sunday, you know, there's that great story where Christ goes to the fig tree to find some fruit and it's dried up. Right. And when he returns to it, he curses it. May fruit never grow on you again. And the apostles are amazed. And that's a sign of Israel, right? That Israel wasn't bearing fruit. And so it withers up. You know, it loses its utility for our Lord. And to see the Cathedral of Notre Dame burning, empty. It's empty and it's burning. Yes, fire is a means of destruction, but it's also a means of purity. And so hopefully there's a purification coming. Purifications are never painless, so they're never easy. But it also kind of seems like France's faith is dried up and it's brittle. It's flammable. It's dangerous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. More than any other country in Western Europe, mm-hmm. France led the apostasy. This is what the French Revolution was. Mm-hmm. And decades before the French Revolution, really the Freemasons, who gathered together in 1717 and dreamed of a day like the day in 1789 when the French Revolution was launched. They had sketched out plans for all of Europe, or all of Western Europe, we should say, all the world in a certain sense.
Yeah.
And so France is sort of the lead sister, the eldest daughter. And it seems to have, you could say France led all of Europe into apostasy. So yeah, I don't think these are grandiloquent claims at all. I think it's mm-hmm. it's reasonable to say, as you did, that this is symbolic kind of chastening. Also, I was in transit yesterday when all this was happening, so I was just getting texts, and then obviously with the iPhones we could kind of get caught up to speed. Mm-hmm. We were on the 5, and the 5 has its own Wi-Fi, but it's slow. So I was mainly getting updates by friends. My buddy Anthony said, bodily chastisement.
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like. You know, I mean, again, I'm blessed with a good cadre of mostly Catholic friends. So I was getting good perspectives, and everyone was just, there's a thread of my buddies just commenting on the video footage, and I hadn't seen any of it. So I was abstracting to it. But this is the concept of the physical chastisement talked about, not just in Fatima, not just at Akita, but like you're saying, going further back into the 19th century apparitions. And it seems altogether relevant that it happens in Paris, which is now Mecca West for Islam, which is arguably the prime instrument of the physical chastisement. I mean, think of it from our American point of view since 2001, and think about Western Europe. It's nearly been lost. It was nearly lost, aside from how many times was Europe nearly lost to the Muslims in the Middle Ages and the early modern period? I mean, even the mid-Middle Ages, Charles Martel, the hammer, stopped the whole continent from falling to Mahometans at the Battle of Tours.
Yeah.
This is the grandfather of Charlemagne. And it just, history keeps playing that moment out over and over again. And then you have today, you wake up and ISIS is celebrating it. And it all feels really apropos of the moral decay of Europe and the world. But the world is Eurocentric because the church built Europe.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so what's funny is an American to be like, in some sense, we feel like we're ground zero. This is kind of like 9/11, except in some sense, some spiritual sense, it's more important than 9/11. And in another sense, we're outsiders because we're in this ex-Protestant republic that is just kind of looking back east, as it were, to the, you know, the great Catholic homeland.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the French Revolution. That's important because the French Revolution transformed this cathedral into a shrine for reason. You know about that?
No.
They took the Notre Dame in 1793 and they reconsecrated as a temple to reason.
Reason. Yeah.
And then also the cult of the Supreme Being, which was Freemasonic. And many of the treasures of the cathedral, I'm just reading it here, were destroyed or plundered. 28 statues of biblical kings at the west facade, mistaken for statues of French kings, were beheaded. This is weird. They're beheading statues. This is like voodoo dolls, you know, that they would go and desecrate statues.
Many of the Jacobins?
Yeah.
Who's doing the desecrating? Yeah.
This is 1793. Many of the heads were found during a 1977 excavation nearby and are on display at the Musée de Cluny. For a time, the goddess of liberty replaced the Virgin Mary on the altars. Imagine this.
Wow.
This is not 2019. This is 1793. These godless Franks, if I might be frank, removed the Blessed Virgin Mary and put up a goddess.
Right.
The goddess of liberté. The cathedral's great bells escape being melted down. All of the other large statues on the facade, with the exception of the statue of the Virgin Mary on the portal of the cloister, were destroyed. The cathedral came to be used as a warehouse for the storage of food and non-religious purposes.
Wow. A warehouse. Desecratory.
Total desecration. Literally, it's a house of commerce.
Right.
In July of 1801, the new ruler, Napoleon Bonaparte, signed an agreement to restore the cathedral to the church. It was formally transferred on the 18th of April, 1802. It was the setting for Napoleon's coronation as emperor on the 2nd of December, 1804, and his marriage to Marie Louise of Austria in 1810. So, and then after that, you know, there's the Hunchback of Notre Dame, whatever. But, I mean, this shows that, I mean, this was bad that the thing got burned, but it's even worse when the eldest daughter of the church basically goes into a teenage rebellion mode and just says, I hate you, Father. I hate you, God. I hate you, Mother, Virgin Mary, and puts up idols, goddesses, and decapitates the heads of biblical kings. And I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, France in the late 18th century, going into the early 19th century with the rule and then the exile and then the quasi retaking of the throne with Napoleon, who was really a pragmatist when it came to religion.
Yeah.
He wasn't the same passionate, burning hater of religion that the Jacobins were, but the revolutionaries were. But he was really he shared a kind of timely dissent, but ended up deciding to use Catholicism to solidify his rule. And you see the teenage rebellion, like all teenage rebellions, it's not fixed, dispassionate. It's not the American Revolution, right? Which was very non-sanguinary. You know, there wasn't a lot of bloodshed in the American Revolution and no unnecessary blood. It was fixed upon principle. Right. Natural rights. And it was as sort of straight a line as could be drawn for a revolution, quite arguably. I mean, I think there's a strong case for that. The French Revolution, on the other hand, everything that was happening and even Napoleon and his couple of reigns, all that transpired in the early 19th century really shows like a teenager, kind of the fits and spurts of teenage passion. Sometimes rebelling, then sort of kissing up to one parent, then maybe kissing up to the other parent. There's a pragmatism there with teenage rebellion. It's not principled most of the time.
Right.
And I mean, this is sort of the worst instance of teenage rebellion. Not all teens go through this, but yeah.
This so is, but this is an ungodly metaphor. Would you say it's an ungodly rage, though? I mean, this is I mean, the French Revolution. It's not just like I'm mad at you or I'm going to break my curfew. This is a this is two middle finger flipping the burr rebellion right here.
Certainly,
I hate mom and dad, and I am going to desecrate them.
This is what I was saying. I was kind of girding the language. I don't want to be maudlin because, you know, most teens don't have something this that I guess there's more passion to the flame than than even a typical teenage rebellion. I mean, if you have an especially bad teenager, the point is there are fits and spurts.
Yeah.
And it's usually not as, you know, known Sir William oriented as the French Revolution was. And then look how the other aspect to it is, look how sustained the French revolutionary spirit has been to this day. You know, it's been thoroughgoing. France has become a quote secular republic, and it's been all but ruined. It's been, well, I mean, like conservative kids that know politics of the day well, the ones that I teach, this is a good kind of sampling, that are decent, you know, good students, honor students, know a little bit about French history, but they don't, they're surprised to learn that France was the eldest daughter of the church. Mm-hmm. And Paris is the eternal city of Rome, right? It's like a twin city of Rome. From a Catholic perspective, they're surprised about this because for the last 200, 250 years, Paris has been the center of godlessness. It's been Sodom.
Yeah, it has. It's a good analogy. And I wonder if this is why God, you know, God always chooses the unlikely. He chose pagan Rome to be the mother and teacher of all the faithful. Is this why he chooses France for a great monarch, for a restoration of all things in Christ politically? It would seem so. It would seem so. So pray for France. More importantly, pray to Our Lady, Notre Dame, Our Lady. Not because the French so revere the building. It's not the building. It's Our Lady. It's the Blessed Mother. In a sense, this is, you know, there's this idea in the media, France, St. Francis, not Pope Francis, St. Francis has this in his theology that churches of Our Lady are Our Lady. When you go into them, you're under her mantle. You're protected by her. And that's what this is. This is a architectural structure that hides you into the mantle and the protection of Our Lady. And so to see it on fire, to see it burn, to see it potentially destroyed, thank God it's not. That's why we had that, you know, inward visceral feeling of sadness and of anger. So let's pray for the church. Let's pray that rosary every day. We're in Holy Week. How's your Lent going, Tim?
It's going. It's going. I mean, I've been sleeping on the floor and I'm tired. So you don't rest well on the floor. Been doing it every night. I was a little bit sick last week, so I took a couple nights and slept in the bed again, but got well. And yeah, it's just not well. How's yours going?
I'm ready to eat some meat. Last night I had a talk with Joy. I said, so let's talk about Easter Sunday. Honey-baked ham and tenderloin. You know, like, let's go all out. I just want meat. I want to eat meat. I want to celebrate the resurrection. So, I'm ready to, you know, the fasting till three has not been as hard as I thought. Something I actually might do more through the year, but the meat, I do miss the meat.
Yeah,
I miss the meats. The meats are good. So, also we were talking about it. I got my Dubia mug. But we also got these cool stickers that people were asking us about, so I'm going to mention them. We got the Dubia. Can you see this, Tim?
Yeah, I can see that.
These are the die-cut stickers. It looks great.
That looks great there.
This is the Doobie Brothers logo, you know, the band. And this is, and it says, Amoris Ain't All Right from the Doobie Brothers, Jesus Is Just All Right. So I polled the watchers on the design of this, and this is actually the one that you, the watchers, kind of help design and choose. So there's that. There's coffee mugs, there's shirts if you want to. And then there's also one of our viewers made this cartoon of us as Crusaders, and it's pretty cool. I like it. It turns out kind of cool with the cutout, you know?
It does. I like near my left foot there, cartoon me's left foot, you have the signature of the artist. It looks really good. That young man did a great job.
Yeah, I saved it. I kept it in here. So
yeah, I like how you did that. That was classy. Yeah.
So I have all that you on the skaters, back of my put this on your skateboard. You look really cool.
That's right.
So, and there's other stuff. So check it out. Underneath the video, you can find these things. People are always like, how do I find the mugs? Just scroll down the video and there's a little bar there, a little kiosk in YouTube, and you can check that out. So also, I realized, Tim, we never give a shout out to these folks, but there are, you know, a good 5,000 to 10,000 people who listen to the audio of this show, not the video. They don't see us.
Right.
I've even met someone who didn't even know what you looked like. He's only ever listened to the audio. So shout out to everybody on iTunes, Stitcher, the whole podcasting community. We love you. We salute you. Hey, please, on iTunes, please do me the big favor and leave a review there. I read all those reviews. So you can give us a 1 to 5 star rating and leave a review. And then, of course, subscribe and like here. And support on Patreon. Tim's new book is live. It hit.
People Sophia, are getting their copies by mail. Yeah, Catholic Republic.
And if you order it through Sophia, which is the publisher, Sophia Institute, you'll get it faster. I talked to Charlie on that. He said they've got them and they're shipping them. So check that out. My new book, Infiltration, the 200-year plot to undermine and destroy the Catholic Church, comes out May 22nd. You can also pre-order that at Sophia Institute. So a little bit of housekeeping there. So everybody, thanks for the support. Thanks for the encouragement. We're moving towards Easter. I pray for all of you guys every night at the Rosary, all the watchers and listeners. So we appreciate y'all. And till next time, Godspeed. Go make a difference.